So each of us inhabit an internally consistent world where raspberries are always red, blueberries are always blue, and kiwis are always green. And because it's internally consistent, we tend to apply that to other people. However, that's not always true, right? So if you look across people, in some cases, you can take this image and delete the L cone, and it will look like this. In individuals with an N cone deletion, it will look like this. And with an S cone deletion, it will look like this. Right. So changing your receptor repertoire will change your perception of the world. The question is, does this also happen in olfaction? How often does it happen? And what kind of effects will we see? So we've all been taught that olfaction uses a combinatorial code. So here are receptors across the top and odors across the side. And here the size of the circle indicates the affinity of the binding response of a given odor to a receptor. We know that odorants activate specific combinations of these receptors. We know that these activation patterns encode information about the odorant, but notice that these two statements don't have a lot of content to them, right? And the way that you know that is that if I probe at all, you realize your knowledge breaks down. So for example, what happens if we lose a single olfactory receptor? So will that change the intensity of a given odor? Will it change the pleasantness of a given odor? Will it change the odor character? What happens? Is it different for cases where the receptor that you've lost is covered by other receptors versus when it's the only receptor, et cetera? We don't know a lot of these questions. So the first case where this receptor variation has really been linked to human perception was in 2007, Andreas Keller and Leslie Vossal's group. Found that this is a snake plot of OR74. There are two particular locations in this receptor that are variable. You can have two different amino acids at position 88, either an R or a W, and two at T133. At 133, T or an M. Humans typically either have the RT or the WM version. Here you can see that in cell culture, if you take the RT version and apply androstenone, it activates the RT version. If you apply it to the WM version, you get much lower affinity, much less activity. This then translates into human perception. So if we take a number of subjects and ask them to rate the intensity and the valence of androstenone, these are violin plots, so the height here tells you how many subjects fall in a particular region. We can see that subjects that have the RT version, here shown in blue, have a much higher median intensity than subjects with the WM version, and similarly have a lower valence. So if you have the functional receptor, you find androstenone to be more intense and less pleasant than if you have the non-functional receptor. So one question when this paper came out was if androstenone was a very special case. So androstenone's been a popular molecule in psychophysics for a long time, has very unusual properties from the physical point of view. Is it a special case that it's very rare that a single receptor will affect perception? And follow-up studies have now extended this to additional receptors, so it looks like it's not, certainly you're not unique. So all five of these receptors have been shown to be linked to perception of these odors. In some cases, it's so for androstenone, it's nice because we know that it affects the intensity, the pleasantness, the odor character, and the detection threshold of androstenone. In other cases, people have looked only specifically at detection threshold or some subset of these. So we, of course, as humans, have over 400 intact olfactory receptors. The question is, we could now go create 395 more papers where we link a specific receptor to specific odor, but that's not particularly appealing. We'd much rather find if there's a general rule for how this genetic variation and receptor affects perception. So we set out to design a study that will do a large number of odors and a large number of people all at once. So we now have 321 human subjects. They've rated 68 odors for the intensity and pleasantness at two different concentrations. We then do a hybrid selection technique. So we sequence the olfactory receptors and identify single nucleotide polymorphisms in the olfactory receptor open reading frame. And then we do a genetic association analysis. So just for demonstration, if you look at the rating of all subjects of androstenone, you find that there's this bimodal distribution. Some people find it to be very intense. Some people think it has essentially no odor. If you split them by OR74 genotype, you get this nice split where the medians are different. People with a functional version of OR74 find it to be more intense than subjects with a WM version. If you instead split them by a different gene, so OR10G4, you see that basically the medians are the same. So OR10G4 is not associated with perception of androstenone. We can now go through all of the different odorant receptors and all of the different odors, both intensity and valence, and see which ones are associated. So this is a pseudo-Manhattan plot. They're actually just binned by chromosome because we're not testing every position along the entire genome, only odorant receptors. We're doing lots and lots of comparisons here. So to correct for the multiple comparisons, we have this black line, which is the false discovery rate. So anything that falls above the black line is significant here. You can see the androstenone OR74, which has now been replicated in a couple of different studies, does pass our criteria, although only barely. And that there are a number of other cases here that pass that are more significant than the androstenone OR74 genotype. So we see that there's significant associations between perception and genetic variation in 25 different odorant receptors. So this is not a rare thing. It happens fairly frequently. So this is all correlational, however, right? We're doing this association analysis. What we'd like to be able to do is get closer to mechanism. The way that we do that in the lab is we use a cell-based luciferase assay to measure these receptor responses to odors. So in brief, this is a cartoon of an olfactory receptor. When an odorant molecule binds the olfactory receptor, it initiates a cyclic AMP cascade. We can transfect cells with the odorant receptor as well as a reporter that responds when the cyclic AMP cascade initiates. And then we can measure, the cell will basically glow with the reporter, and we can measure the response as we change the concentration of a given ligand. So one caveat to this assay is that it doesn't work for all odorant receptors. So humans have 400 intact olfactory receptors, shown here in gray. The ones in red are ones where we have a ligand for them. And you can see that it's kind of encouraging that they're spread out across the different families, but still fairly discouraging that if you put them in this bar chart and you have a 400 of them, that really only about 12% of them do we have a known ligand for. Right? So in other words, over 80% of the receptors, we have no ligand for them. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know what features they're detecting. We know nothing about them. Right? So one possibility is that this assay is missing some crucial component. And so what we can do now is look at our association data. Right? So let's look at the top 10 associations. And we see that this is not dependent on our assay being functional. So it could point to cases where a particular odor is activating a receptor, but in our assay it's not working. Right? And so sort of a priori, we expect that if 80% of these receptors aren't working in the assay, that you know 8 out of 10 of these will fail to show any activity in our assay as well. And that's not what we see. So 9 of these 10, we can find an odor receptor that responds right in the linked region that responds to the odor. Only for this 2-butanone have we not yet found a receptor that responds to it. Okay, so this is a little bit surprising to us. And it seems to sort of mesh with another finding, right? At least our optimistic version of it is that so a Belgian group recently looked at OR gene expression in human olfactory epithelium, right? So people have looked at mouse fairly frequently, but human very rarely. So in 2014, they did a microarray analysis looking at odorant receptor expression in the epithelium. They had 13 women and 13 men. One of their findings is that not all odorant receptors are expressed in the human olfactory epithelium. So even though we have 400 intact olfactory receptors, a lot of them just aren't even expressed. And if you look at the ones that work in the assay, ones where we have a ligand, a published ligand for them, they tend to be enriched in this assay, right? So the ones at the top in pink here, so everything in pink here has a ligand, and basically you're enriching for things that are highly expressed in the olfactory epithelium. So one possible interpretation, although certainly not the only interpretation, is that maybe only a fraction of intact ORs are involved in olfaction. People have noticed that expression of odor receptors occurs in non-olfactory tissue. Maybe a lot of the olfactory receptors that have been preserved in the repertoire are expressed in the heart or the kidney or the lung and subserving some other function, and not necessarily subserving perception. So the ones that we find in our genotype-phenotype association analysis, where we're looking specifically at perception, tend to work in our assay system. And we've also possibly discovered ligands for them because we've tested primarily with volatiles, right? Whereas things elsewhere in the body might be responding to non-volatiles. So now we're going to look at a specific example a little more carefully. So we'll zoom in on glycol, which is here on chromosome 11. So if you zoom in on this region, you can see that that olfactory receptor occurs in a cluster here. This is extremely common in the genome. They typically occur in these clusters. The problem with that when you're doing association analysis is that you have a lot of linkage in a given cluster in the genome. So if OR10G4 has a given SNP, it may tag OR10G7 as well. So the SNP here might be highly correlated with the SNP here. So the whole region being correlated with each other, it's very difficult to dissociate which of these particular olfactory receptors is the causal receptor. So basically, to solve this resolution problem, what we can do is clone up all the different variants of all the different olfactory receptors that occur in this region and test them with a given odor. So when we do that in this region, we identify that the best SNP occurs in 10G4, and indeed 10G4 is the only receptor that responds to glycol in this cluster. There are four particular allelic variants that occur of OR10G4. So you can see the blue, the orange, the green, and the pink allele here. The blue and the orange are responsive to glycol, and the green and the pink are largely non-responsive to glycol. Subjects who have the blue and the pink versions rate the intensity of glycol higher than subjects who have the green and the pink versions. And similarly, as with androsterone, both more intense and less pleasant. OK, so now can we look the other direction? Can we take our cell culture data and try to predict, see what happens in behavior? So it turns out that there were two other, in our cell culture data, we tried a number of different molecules against this receptor before we had this finding from the association study. And we know that 10G4 also responds to vanillin and ethylvanillin. And you can see that all three of these are quite structurally related to each other. So the question is now, if OR10G4 responds to vanillin and ethylvanillin, will we also see that intensity and pleasantness vary in these cases? And what we find is that they don't. So the median lines are essentially the same in all these cases. Genetic variation in OR10G4 does not predict your perception of vanillin and ethylvanillin. So the major difference between, right, so why is it that glycol works and vanillin and ethylvanillin don't? So the major difference between these dose response curves is that the affinity here is much, much higher for glycol than it is for vanillin, right, about three orders of magnitude. And so what we did is we took every case where we had some sort of cell culture data and also some sort of data in a genotype-phenotype analysis, and we plot the EC50 along the x-axis here versus the p-value of the association on the y-axis here. Okay? So we did this for both intensity and for pleasantness. And what this means essentially is that if I say that I've deorphined a receptor, but that's only because I test a ligand at 1 millimolar concentrations, which is quite high, then it's very unlikely that I'm going to get any sort of association with behavior. So that sort of concentration probably doesn't occur very frequently physiologically. And so to say that I deorphin something when it's that high is not very useful. Okay? However, if I have a high affinity relationship between an odor and a ligand, then it's a lot more likely that we'll be able to predict perception. You'll note that there are still a lot of dots here along the bottom. And so we'll discuss sort of why those might occur. Right? Why is it that not every single case where we have a cell culture result where an odor activates a receptor do we also get some sort of signal or genotype-phenotype analysis? Okay, so first of all, we think that the concentration that we're testing at is very important, right? So we can either frame it as an affinity question or as a concentration that we're testing the odors at. And so if I test at a concentration that corresponds to this point, then I would expect that glycol would work because there's some sort of differential response between orange-blue versus green-pink. Whereas here, basically, they're all the same sort of activity value. There's no difference. I would expect no difference in perception. If instead I tested a higher concentration of glycol, vanillin, and ethylvanillin, then I would expect that in all three of these cases, I would get some sort of behavioral response. So this particular experiment is actually really difficult to do because vanillin and ethylvanillin have very low vapor pressures. So we can't get them high enough to sort of expect that. But more generally, just to sort of drive this point home, if I test, so this doesn't really show up at all, if I test over in this particular region, I would expect that there'd be no difference, right? It's okay. If I test very far to the right, I would expect no difference. However, if I hit the sweet spot and test the concentration that corresponds to this differential region between the orange and the blue, then I would expect some sort of behavioral result. And so we can look through our data and find examples of this. So for example, this particular receptor responds to 2-ethylfenchol. we see that there are very that if we tested it, right? So again, in our association analysis, we tested at two different concentrations. If we look at the low concentration, we see no association with perception. And so, you know, conceptually, that could correspond to this domain. If we increase the concentration of 2-ethylfenchol, then we see a significant association. The blue receptor starts to respond here. That explains one version. We also see the opposite case, where with diacetyl, if you test at low concentration, you get a significant response. But if you test at a higher concentration, you get no significance. OK, so another reason that combinatorial coding fails to predict behavior is that multiple ORs might be responsible. So here, for example, if I look at this particular odor, there are three receptors that all respond to it. If all three of those odors are important to the perception of the odor, then we'll fail to see any one of them be associated, possibly. So here, for example, we have OR10G7 and a variant of it. You can see that the reference version, the one that's most common in the genome, does not respond to this odor eugenol. However, the version with one amino acid flip responds quite robustly with a very high affinity. Turns out there are a lot of variants of OR10G7 ranging across a variety of EC50s. So you can see the version here has essentially no response. The version here has a very high affinity. If we only look at OR10G7 and try to explain the amount of variance in intensity perception for eugenol, we only explain about 4% of it. But eugenol actually activates a lot of different receptors. So here's a full list. These are a number of other receptors that also respond to eugenol. And you can see that there's a range of EC50s. Now, if we use all these odorant receptors together, then we can start to see that we explain a much larger percentage of the variance. So in this case, we can be overfitting. So this isn't a perfect value for what's going on. And we're trying to do a better job of sort of figuring out exactly how to deal with this data. But still, if you have multiple receptors, looking at this sort of genotype-phenotype analysis approach misses a lot of things. So more recently, right, everything I've told you so far has really been about agonism. How can I take an odorant activator receptor? But there's also a decent amount of antagonism in the system. And so we'd like to exploit that. So for example, genetic variation OR74 explains about 39% of the variance in androstenone intensity. And so building on this genetic model, if we're able to identify an antagonist for OR74, we'd expect that the antagonist would also reduce the perceived intensity of androstenone. So then the question is, can we use some sort of method to identify these antagonists? And of course, we turn back to our in vitro screening technique. So basically, in this case, we transfect all the wells on a plate with OR74. We apply the EC80 concentration, right, the concentration that activates 80% of maximum, to all the wells. So we bump up all the activity. We then apply a different volatile to each well, searching for antagonists. And then on a second plate as a control, we substitute forskolin for the agonist to rule out nonspecific inhibition, so if any odors that are killing cells, for example, things like that. And so this is a subset of the data. Basically, we can plot this such that inhibition is on the y-axis here, and each dot is a different odor compound potential antagonist. And so in this case, the 100 is set to the no odor condition, and the 0 is set to the EC80 concentration of androstenone, the activity of that. And you can see that there are, if we set this line at about 90% inhibition, we have two candidates that pop out above that line. And I'll show you one of them. We've done this with two of them, but this is one of the antagonists. And you can see there's a nice dose-response relationship showing that as you increase the concentration of this antagonist, it knocks down the activity of OR74 when activated by androstenone. So then we do a quick psychophysics experiment. So this is sort of modeled after Mark Spear's technique with the borzinol receptor, where subjects take three sniffs. So the first sniff is always androstenone, and the third sniff is always androstenone. They sniff androstenone and rate intensity on both of these cases. What we're trying to figure out is what happens to the if the intensity of androstenone drops from the first trial to the third trial, if we give different conditions in the middle. So if you sniff androstenone, a control odor in androstenone, how much does your intensity perception of androstenone drop? And the answer is not much at all. So you're not different from 100% in this case, where 100% is the intensity rating on the first sniff. If you give the antagonist, it drops to about half of the intensity value, and it's significantly different. And if you do androsterone, 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 then you get adaptation. And you can see this is actually fairly similar to what our antagonist is doing. So our antagonist is not completely shutting off the receptor. In this case, it's simply bringing it down to the level of adaptation. So you'll also note that the affinity here is fairly weak for antagonist. We did a general screen just looking for things out of the box. It's conceivable that we can optimize these antagonists to get a higher affinity antagonist and knock this down even further. So we've also done this with simultaneous presentation, so we can give an agonist and antagonist at the same time rather than in successive sniffs. So in this case, I'm looking at data where we have a receptor for the odor trimethylamine, which is fishy, and we have an antagonist that we found that has this green odor. Basically, we deliver the different concentrations of the agonist and antagonist to the subject and have them rate how fishy is the odor, how green is the odor, and how pleasant is the odor. So when we do that, right, so here on the x-axis is different concentrations of the fishy odor TMA, and on the y-axis is the fishiness intensity. So as we would expect, as you increase the concentration of the fishy odor, people rate the fishiness as going up. If you then give them the fishy odor along with antagonists at the same time, you can see that you knock this down. So this is only with six subjects, but it's a fairly strong effect. We're pursuing this with more people. So all this effort looking at things that activate and inactivate receptors has led us sort of down a future path toward digitizing olfaction, right? So the idea is that everybody in the room has a phone where they can take a picture and send that picture to someone across the world. They could pull up an image repeatedly without degrading it. They can archive that photo and store it indefinitely, and we can't do any of that in olfaction, right? And the reason for that is largely that in vision, things have been digitized, right? So an example here is the hex codes. So if you're typing a color into a web page, for example, you can give a hex code, and essentially there's six digits here where the first digits tell you how high to turn on your red channel, the second digits how high you should turn on your green channel, and the third how high you should turn on your blue channel. So you can turn on red and you'll get this color, green and you'll get this color. If you turn on both red and green, you'll get the yellow, right? So we know what the primary colors are. We can mix the primary colors together to make new colors. And so how do we do this in olfaction? So of course, the reason that we can do this in vision is that we really understand what's going on at the receptor level. So we have a stimulus space that's unidimensional of wavelength. We know the response functions for the three different cones. And these response functions are fairly easy to get in the sense that you can test a couple points on this curve and extrapolate to other points. If you do this in olfaction, we have 400 receptors instead of three. As I said before, a lot of them, we don't know what's going on. We don't know any odors that activate them. Even the ones in red, we often know, you know, one to a dozen odors that activate them. And so this problem is a lot more difficult to sort of get a full response function. We don't know the stimulus space, et cetera, et cetera. But in theory, if we can find an agonist for every single olfactory receptor that activates only one receptor and no other receptors, then we should be able to control all the input channels to the olfactory system and make anything that we want. So obviously that's a far-off goal, but that's sort of where this is pointing. So I'll give a summary of this. So first of all, genetic variation in single olfactory receptors frequently associates with perceptual features. This is not an anomaly, where androsterone is a special case. Approximately a quarter of our tested odors, we get some sort of association where a single olfactory receptor matters. So the combinatorial code does not seem to be highly redundant. Behavior matches results from our cell-based assay in 9 of our top 10 associations. This is surprising to us in that the cell-based assay doesn't work for all receptors, but the receptors it does work for seem to be enriched for ones that are relevant to perception. Our in vitro screening predicts behavior for high affinity interactions. It's not perfect, but it seems to do a fairly good job. And it also can be used to identify antagonists that lead to perceptual blocking. So again, we're going from a molecular level to a perceptual level using this screening technique. And finally, there's no obvious theoretical barrier stopping us from turning an odor into a digital signal and playing back that odor using a set of primary odors. The main problem here is getting enough data to identify what the particular ideal set of primary odors would be. So finally, I'd like to thank the members of my lab, as well as collaborators who've worked on this project, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Time for questions.
Eric.
Right. When you say a particular OR explains this or that data, you actually mean that particular SNP explains the data. And then also, I presume these SNPs are heterozygous, so how does that affect how you interpret what the...
Yeah, so we're primarily looking at the allele basis. So we get the full allele of the receptor and separate them out. So for example, in OR10G4, I was showing you all four alleles. So we're basically doing multiple linear regression and getting get some sort of percent variance, so R squared.
I wanted to ask, so have you considered trying to look at these associations more than the two axes of intensity and valence? Have you sort of just simply asked questions about, or can you plausibly ask questions about sort of discriminability or anything like that that might essentially allow patient, you know, subjects to, you know, sort of give you a more refined set of perceptions?
So you want like similarity between odors?
Or something like that. I don't know, right? I mean, just something that might allow them to capture. I guess the issue is that you don't know what to compare it to, basically, right?
Right. So there are two techniques for doing that. One is basically the Dravnik's analysis, where you have a particular odor word. So how orange is this? How citrus is this? How green is this? And you do all that rating for a bunch of different odors, and then you can get some sort of similarity in perception that way. And there's a little bit of that data in this data set, so they did that for some of these odors and not others. But it's very difficult to interpret in a straightforward manner. It's a lot harder than doing intensity and pleasantness associations, but I think there might be something there. The other way to do it is do pairwise similarity, where you basically, instead of having a verbal landmark, which comes with all its semantic overhead, you can just do comparisons between two different compounds. And so we're doing some of that work in a different context. And there are computational models now for predicting similarity of mixtures and things like that. And so we're working with that also as a way to identify primary odors, right? So if you have an algorithm that will let you predict the similarity of two mixtures, in theory, you could use that algorithm to then identify the ideal set of primary odors. Then you can take those primary odors, put them on receptors, and see if they activate them in some straightforward way. Are you getting unique sets of receptors that are activated by primary odors? So we're going after it that way. But we have less. We have not gone after it in the sense of getting subjects to do a lot of similarity comparisons and then genotype them.
So I have a question about the variability. You have a behavioral test on the human subject.
Yep.
And are they all was the same age, how they choose them, and if there is really some order that they don't perceive? Because I'm asking the question because it seems that the human olfactory bulb is very, very different from any other species.
Yeah, so there's a lot of variability in olfactory perception for sure. So yes, we have some odors that people don't smell. Androsterone is one of them, right? A lot of people don't smell androsterone, but other people smell it extremely strongly, right? So there are a lot of cases like that. We have picked some of these odors specifically because they're highly variable, right? So you'd expect that there would be some genetic basis for a lot of those cases. So we view that variability as a plus instead of a minus, right? If we had a bunch of genetically identical mice, then our association study would get nothing. The whole point here is that we have extremely high variability both in genotype and in phenotype, which gives us a lot of power to look at the relationship between the two. And in terms of test retests, we have quantified that, and so yes, there's a lot of variability there as well. If you bring somebody in later, 2 weeks later, how much does their intensity rating of the same odor change? So yes, that does exist as well, and accounts for some reasonably high portion of variance, actually.
It was the same age, the groups of the people, or different age?
So age has so that right? The estimate that OR74 explains 39% of variance, that model already factors in gender and age and a couple other things as well. So yes, those have big influences on stuff, but you can factor it out to some degree to get a feel for what's going on.
A comment about the human olfactory bulb being dramatically different from others. It's not. It has many more glomeruli. It has almost 5,000 glomeruli, but it has close to 50,000 mitral cells, a large population of granular cells, periglomerular cells, and in fact the synaptic organization is identical to what we see in the mouse. It's not clear why there are so many glomeruli. It's probably more divergent as it is in the accessory olfactory bulb, but otherwise all the fundamental features are there.
I speak about the uniqueness of each person of their order groups, yeah.
Joel, at the risk of opening a can of worms, this idea of the dimensionality of order space seems to kind of regularly rear its head. And in your case, it seems like you've got a quarter of these receptors where, you know, variability and sequence gives you a perceptual effect independent of other odorants. So if you've got sort of 25% of odorant receptors that show this effect, does this tell us anything about sort of the, you know, the number of dimensions that might be used to encode odors?
So we haven't tried to pin a number on it, but we think it's useful for getting at dimensionality. So, okay, identifying the primary odors will solve the dimensionality problem, right? So we've approached it sort of from that perspective. If we find a set of, right, if we solve the matrix essentially, then and figure out how many dimensions there are, then that will solve the problem. So we've more approached it from that direction. How can we, right, so, and we've done this also less quantitatively by asking, for example, a flavorist. Right, so if you could go pick a set of 40 compounds, for example, that could make all foods, how well would you do, right? And one flavor says he can give us 40 compounds that will do about 85% of foods, and so we're trying to, it won't be perfect, right, it'll be some version of a match, and you can increase that number and sort of get some idea of the resolution that you'll work at, right? So we're starting to work on that by using olfactometer that can mix a lot of these things together and figure that out. So we're trying to solve that question, but it's a big one.
So I guess you pointed out there's an association between the abundance of expression and the degree to which we have ligands for these receptor genes. But it looked like that wasn't, while there seemed to be an effect there, it wasn't a perfect correlation or anything like that, right?
Yeah.
We have ligands for some receptors that are expressed among the lower levels as well, all right, yeah.
Yeah.
So have there been localization studies done on these? Your other hypothesis that maybe these aren't actually even expressed in the nose. I mean, is it presumably that would be a question that one could address relatively directly. Maybe not in humans, or harder.
You can do it in humans, but people haven't because it's been difficult to acquire tissue. Not terribly difficult, but people have tended not to. So more people are looking at doing RNA sequencing in humans and getting a better picture of this stuff. But getting a full epithelium from a human so you really know what's there is challenging.
Sure.
It can be done, but it's not something that you routinely do. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so people are getting a better idea. This is a microarray study. It's not particularly perfect. Also, right, some of the cases where we don't have a ligand for receptors because we haven't tried enough odors. So there's, right, so there are about 50 published receptors with ligands. There's a commercial company that claims they have closer to 100 already because they've simply tried more molecules. So it's unclear exactly what that final number will be. So I'm sure we're missing some for trivial reasons, but yeah.
Sure.
This continuation of the first Tim's question when he asked about the different correlation with intensity and, you know, did you check the similarity matrix, are very basic features of the odorants and relationship to the receptors, the detections they showed. Did you have any knowledge about if you knocking up, if you lacking the receptor, the detection they showed for a specific odor will be different, and how that's related, because this is kind of basics, maybe.
Wait, say that again.
Detection threshold for the odor.
So a lot of people have looked at detection threshold, right? So if you look at the list, most people approach this problem from a detection threshold because they believe that that would be a more sensitive measure of what's going on. So in the data set, we have some detection thresholds. So in androsterone, for example, there are both detection thresholds and intensity and pleasantness measurements. the power for detection threshold is much, much lower than it is for intensity. The effect size is much lower than it is for intensity and pleasantness. Whether that's due to variability in, in collecting detection thresholds or what is a little unclear, but it's extremely fast to detect, to get intensity ratings from subjects. It's really hard to get detection threshold, and the effect sizes seem to be smaller for detection thresholds in general. And so we have typically shied away from doing a lot of detection threshold work and gone more towards super threshold intensity. Not that I don't think there's anything there, but
what would be your prediction if, you know, the subject lacking a few receptors that is sensitive to this order, how that affect the
So with androstenone, right, it's sensitive to it. If you lose it, then your detection threshold gets worse, right? As it, right, if you
any other examples?
What's that?
Other examples.
So the same with, so I mean, I put them up there. So cis-3-hexanol and 2J3, and what's the other one? I think 5A1 beta-ionone is also detection threshold, and the isovaleric acid. So most of the examples were detection threshold. Yeah.
All right, if there are no more questions, let's thank our speaker again. All right. Okay, our next speaker is Chakra. Chakra has worked in the area of computer vision, and we are lucky to have attracted him to the field of olfaction.